Because I feel like that there's two parts to that question. I mean, one is how I knew about spirituality and my interest in spirituality, which was, from a very young age when I felt as a gay man or as a gay teenager, I felt separate from what culture was teaching me. And I knew there had to be a different way. So I started to look into deeper questions, especially because it was during the AIDS crisis and I had many friends who were sick and dying. And so I was really looking at illness and death, by the time I was 17 or 18. I mean, these were already issues that that I was facing, that I did, that I don't think most teenagers have to think about. And so I was propelled to question the reality that most people accept of, that what culture gives us as the goals of our life, of achievement and wealth and power and all those things. I started to question all that early on. So that's one piece. I mean, that I definitely feel, is where my journey started, is in difference, in being different and outside. And I'm really interested in that. I'm very, very committed to understanding the role of the outsider and the voice of the people that aren't in power and empowered in general, and trying to amplify those voices. That's really what my work has been focused on.
Okay. So as I listen in to, let's just call it the position, that geographic kind of inner space positioning of the experience of being outside, and then amplifying your interest about others who might also have that sense, right? I'm wondering how that landed in you, not just as an awareness, but as a potential spark for action, right? So moving from interest and that positioning, right, that identity, to, well, I might actually act differently than just have this awareness about it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about as the second piece to that first question, was like around why I felt motivated to do some things to serve in some way. And I think I think I've always just had this desire to be a use in the world and really committed to wanting to help remove the suffering of others. Like I've always felt that drive. I can't even quite define it. It's just been in my consciousness since I was a child. My father was a photographer, a photojournalist, and traveled all over the world. And I remember always looking at his photographs and thinking, I really like to reach out to the world in the way he had. So I think he modeled for me that kind of this larger connection. He just traveled so much, and I'm intrigued by that idea of connecting with
Okay.
people. Yeah.
Okay. So when we kind of snoop around or search around for these roots of the sparks of inspiration, particularly in the context of wisdom traditions, we often do land in the elements, right? These basic informants of our embodied life. And so I'm hearing you talk about the view, the vision, and that particular way in which his perception through his photographic capacity got transferred over to you. And so let's just welcome that, almost like a river flowing through your DNA, the way the wisdom traditions flow through many of us who are practitioners, so that as you breathe into and welcome that gift, right, of the context of your arising, the environment from which you grew, even though you had difference. Let's see if we can further clarify the how that actually worked in you, almost like, you know, a particular alchemical substance that you claimed as your own. Can we play with that a little bit?
Yeah, I like that. That's awesome. I think I was a visual artist at that time. I mean, I always used to do art. And so it's interesting you mentioned the visual, because that was so important to me. And that's what I studied in school. Painting and drawing was my whole life, really, at that time. And then there was a moment where I think I had a realization that it didn't feel like service enough to be creating art. I felt like that somehow was limited in some way, that I didn't know if I could affect the change that I wanted to do, the service I wanted to offer in the world, just through visual medium, actually. So I remember when I discovered yoga, which was also quite young. It had always been there. My grandmother taught me yoga as well when I was a small child. And then I came back to it right after college. And it actually felt like a medium that I could work in more than just visual art. So yoga became to me a more, a much deeper medium, because it was spiritual. It was like the teachings and the practice, and it was embodied, and it had so many layers of potential for me, for my own work and service, I think, simultaneously. So I appreciate you asking that, because I actually don't think I've really ever verbalized that before, that it wasn't simply, I didn't simply go back to yoga because it was good for me personally, but I actually think I could see that it's a powerful medium to work through. Do you know what I mean? That it was like, instead of just painting, yoga actually has so much more depth.
So, right. Right. Well, no, well, thank you. So as I listen, I see images as I listen. It's just part of my practice, in some of the deeper Buddhist practices that I engage in. And I'm watching a whole kind of panorama open up around the back side of you for some reason, as you kind of reach in to the origins of your, I don't know, embodied becoming as someone who's able to swim through the gift into a more expanded field of vision. And then you describe so beautifully the many other parts of you that began to play together, almost like a theater or an opera, or rock concert, however you want to put it. And so what happens then for me is, if it's true that it began to have a life of its own, this service, mm-hmm. I'm wondering, from the direction of your attention, right, as your intention to serve changed, visual artist, not enough, embodied practice, spirituality, and this building, this kind of sculpting, let's call it, shaping of the who you are now as someone who I'm calling us yoga innovators, for the lack of a better term, or emerging leaders, mm-hmm. relative to the wisdom traditions. So the cloak that I saw is now, right, you just kind of took off another layer physically.
Did that for you.
So as your heart and mind begin to work together, what else emerges from the perspective of alchemy and refinement? Tell me more. How did service really come to life?
Well, I landed in a place where, you know, it was San Francisco in the early 90s, where AIDS was taking over. So I was actually in an epidemic, you know, much like we are now. And that it was not, it was a crisis, so it didn't feel, and even before that, I was already involved in the late 80s. While I was in college, I would go back to New York, where I grew up, and I was, I would start attending ACT UP meetings, and I could feel the energy that was happening there. It was like the energy of service and revolution and people wanting change and wanting to be heard. Because the AIDS epidemic was the interesting situation, especially now seeing how this situation is playing out. It's easy to look back and see what didn't happen during AIDS, which was that there was really very little attention given in the early years. The government would not speak of it. there's so much homophobia and a lot of hatred, and so that was clearly a place I could offer service. So I was very drawn to that and started, you know, with it, activism. I mean, I was on the streets. And it just took a while, I think, in my own maturity, just to kind of, in my own spiritual practice, to kind of evolve enough beyond just yelling at people to realize that there was something I could do that's more productive. So that's what I mean, that yoga became, you know, the medium and the focus of my service, that I could then see, oh, I could share yoga with my community rather than just be angry and sad about the people that were suffering and dying. And literally in 1995, I had been studying yoga for a long time by then, and I had actually been doing a mentorship with an individual teacher who was an incredible gift to me. You know, I spent 4 years with her, Kazuko Onodera is her name, and she was a Japanese yoga teacher in Berkeley, and she had brought me on as her apprentice, and she was very patient, and she was teaching me to cook and to garden, and she was teaching me how to be a person, you know, but I was frustrated. I wanted to go and serve, right? So I left her after 4 years and went and took a regular teacher training program. And so I just wanted to be out there serving, offering, and giving. So I started teaching in 1995. And at the same time that my best friend died of AIDS, actually in 1995. So that was a turning point year for me where I think, you know, I realized yoga is the means I could use to serve the community that I was committed to caring for.
Okay. Thank you for that. So I'm sensing into this quality of, I guess, practicality or utility that you're naming. So not anger and yelling anymore. And then your 4 year hiatus learning to cook and kind of be quieter, I guess it would be part of elementally just quieter around the conditions. And then to find your way, and this is where the questions arrive, that there are others who begin to come into the frame of this awakening toward the we. And so that nexus of anger transmuting your energy into something else, can you say a little bit more about how others began to help lift your care around service? And as you landed in your body more, I'm assuming too at that point, that you could create a landing strip for something else to emerge, to become more visible with others.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's important, a really important point, because I think anger is the, I don't know, the surface level, it's the easiest direction to turn, you know, in trauma and in frustration. Well, frustration is a kind of anger, isn't it? It's just, anger is just where I feel, and maybe it's just me personally, but I feel like we can go so easily there. And it allows us to avoid so much, you know, we avoid facing our own responsibility, our own responsibility to actually create something. So, I mean, I think that that's exactly what was going on, is I started to realize, I actually had a moment, there was an actual moment where I, and I think I wrote about this somewhere, but I was at an AIDS demonstration, you know, where it was like a march on the streets in San Francisco. And at this time, there was actually another side. There was like a group that we were protesting or something. And so there were two opposing groups and they had met up, and they were just so, there was so much anger there. I mean, it's just really, you know, you can imagine these kind of yelling and screaming, like a very, I think, conservative religious group and then this AIDS activist group. And I had been practicing for a while, and I just had this kind of, I don't know, recoil feeling. Like I just had to get back, you know, get away from that. And I remember seeing these two men at the front screaming at each other on either side, you know, two men from the two different sides yelling at each other. And they looked so similar, you know, like they were both angry and red and screaming. And I kind of had this real realization, oh wait, this is, anger is only going to get you so far. Like, this is not the way I need to be going. In fact, what I saw is that those two men were basically the same in their anger, and they were stuck there. And so I really was, I actually left and I stopped. That was the end of my activism in that regard, of being like angry on the streets, because it felt very limited. And I don't mean to say, I mean, there's a place for it. You know, I think demonstrating in a way is the grossest level for this kind of change to occur. Like, we need civil disobedience. I feel strongly about that. But there has to be deeper work done. And I think that's what you're asking about. And I really appreciate that question, because I think that's the harder part. It's harder to be creative and problem solve and build community and build something else, build something positive, when something is being destroyed. You know, it's just, it's easy when there's destruction to be angry about it and to just lash out. And I think, to me, it's the work is in the next step, you know, to be creative and create something, yeah, creating something new, a new way.
Right. Thank you. So, you know, we could pick up a sutra or a million and take a look at what you just said, or a story.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'd love to. Can we talk about the Bhagavad Gita? Because that's definitely what comes to my mind when you talk about war and anger. I mean, there's literally a line in the Gita, and maybe I should read it. I mean, if that's useful, but... you know, in chapter 2, where Krishna is describing the problem of, you know, the human condition, basically, and what we generally do. And then he's trying to show Arjuna that you can live another way. You can have a spiritual life. Can I find that one?
Sure. We have all the time in the world.
What?
We have all the time in the world.
Yeah, here it is. It's chapter 2 and sloka 62 and 63. From brooding on sense objects, attachment to them arises. Out of that attachment, personal desire is born. And from desire, anger appears. Anger confuses the thinking process, which in turn disturbs memory. When memory fails, reasoning is ruined. And when reason is gone, one is lost. But the yogi who has disciplined the mind and has control of the senses can move about amidst sense objects, free of attraction and aversion, settling more deeply in tranquility. And in that tranquility, all sorrows fall away, because the discerning intellect of a calm mind is soon secure in equilibrium. Well, and I'll pause for a moment. But by the way, this is my favorite section, so of course I'm reading it, but I can pause for a moment. I don't know. Isn't that nice, though, where he talks about anger?
It's beautiful. But the thing that I'd like just to do a dotted line, or maybe a straight line, is that through your story, you were evoking exactly what you went back to reference. Mm-hmm. So let's just zoom out again to the impact of the wisdom traditions finding their way in whatever context in our modern times, you know, outside of the monasteries, outside of the ashrams. And that right there in that encounter, when you said, I recoiled, it gave me a clue, Duna, of the who in you was waking up more significantly, that articulated other aspect that had opened a window toward a new action, right? You said it, that's when the new happens. So that's exactly the little horse paddock or you know, unfenced domain that I'm trying to get more visible for the readers, because it's personal, right? And it's universal. Right. And so if then the next question might be, as you realize, oh my gosh, it's all here now all the time anyway, then you pick up the stick and you go over to the other side. And the stick image is the one from Moses, you know, when Moses finally listened and God said to Moses, just put your stick there and the water will be revealed. And then the others came to drink. So those are leadership moments of the moving from me to we. So if that's your context, right, that we're kind of inhabiting, both with the sutras from the Gita and then your experience, how did that begin to manifest or take form in your project or projects?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's where accessible yoga began. That's the main project I have. I mean, I realized that rather than protesting, I could do something more creative and serviceful, and that would be to share yoga with my community. So I literally started teaching yoga for people with HIV and AIDS. I mean, that's what I started to do. So I just put my energy there. And it was really powerful and transformative for me. I mean, I found people were really thirsty for the teachings, and really, especially people who were facing illness and disability and death, they became my teachers. You know, literally, I mean, it's not just, I know that's an expression. We all say our students are our teachers, but I mean, literally they became my teachers because they actually, I mean, to be around someone who, you know, is in their 20s and, you know, in the 80s, or when this was the 90s by now, in the 90s still, AIDS was barely treatable. There was very few medications. So many of my students died. I volunteered in an AIDS hospice and I got to work with people that were, you know, dying. So that was just, it was just very educational for me and opened my awareness more to the shared human condition of this, you know, of having this limited time here in this body and mind, and how we, you know, what do you do with that time? What can you do to make it worthwhile? So anyway, I started teaching a lot, and it just, those classes just kept expanding, and I started including people with different disabilities, and literally accessible yoga was born from that shift from the angry demonstrating to wanting to actually just share yoga with people, to support them, to give them access to the spiritual teachings that, like you mentioned, that was my goal, was to give people access to these teachings because they were helping me.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just snoop around a little bit more into the intelligence of the heart. As the Presencing Institute and these questions around the prototyping of an awareness-based change-making process that incorporate many of the wisdom tradition's precepts, the practices and the processes, right, just like you were saying, begin to blend into embodied action, full human beingness. And so as you witness your own heart mind now string or create this constellation called the who you are in this moment, can you sink in a little more deeply underneath the surface to ask again, where am I when I meet my doubt about whether or not I can be truly useful?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. You ask really good questions, I think. I didn't think doubt was going to be in that question, so you got me. Doubt is a big challenge for me. I think I'm generally an insecure person, and so I feel like I I've tried to embrace that as part of my practice. And I think my practice is a lot about understanding my own relationship between my mind and my heart, between my mind and spirit. And through my study, I see that that's really the goal. In fact, even in the quote that I read, I mean, there's a short phrase here that I think is very interesting. And that's the discerning intellect of a calm mind. And I'm really intrigued by this idea of clear thinking versus egoism. And I think that's what comes up for me, is just that question of ego and how much was I doing it for myself? Was I actually doing it as service to really focus on others? And that it's a blurred line, because you can be serving yourself as you take care of others. I mean, they go together, which I guess gets back to your point about the me and the we. But I would say that I too often hear spiritual teachers use a lot of platitudes around the idea that we're all one, you know what I mean? Which is spiritual bypassing, and that's disregarding the challenges and suffering of people, especially those who've been marginalized. So I think it's really important to not just go to we're all one, and to really look at how we're different. And the only way I can think of doing that personally is to constantly reflect on my own position, which is what you're asking me to do, actually, is very interesting. Because I think of it as a reflection on a position, you know, culturally, like as a white man, some, you know, what power am I given versus as a gay man, what do I not get? You know, as a native English speaker, you know, as someone who has enough money to be safe, like there's certain things that I try to be conscious of all the time to be, so I can remain conscious of my position and also my role in the world. When I step into, service, what am I bringing into that? Do you know what I mean?
I do. So you're right at the opening of the cave of the unknowing, right? From the esoteric's many spiritual traditions. And so if in this kind of emergent space, right, where we're disoriented from the personal, and yet we're not yet oriented to the universal, and it has everything to do with no separation and nothing to do with that. Because there's still gravity, there's still one step and then the next step. Mm-hmm. So the questions that emerge in this more liminal space, the less easy to see, feel, or sense space, is, as you reflect, what do you know that you have let go of in order to make room for this release of your true gift into the sacred?
I think the more I can be honest with myself about what I'm looking for, what I'm trying to get, my own needs, my ego, and how it comes in, I think the more of service I can be. So rather than denying those things, which I think is how I feel like I've been trained in a sense to deny my needs and myself, my ego's needs, I actually think being very forward about them and honest with myself about it is much more effective. And yeah.
And you speak now a couple of times about creating, right? From those visual threads, and then this trying and trying again, that's part of this prototyping. As we probe into this new reality and become more available for the gifts that sometimes we're nervous about that might not be received for whatever reason. And that translates energetically. And so as you witnessed yourself in this more complete way, let's just name it, even while the fluctuations, the blah blahs, you know, go around, who else, what other supports have been coming in to help move it forward?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I think that's I think that's exactly what happens when I'm honest with, when I'm more honest about my needs and who I am, and more revealing. If I reveal my struggle and my personal, you know, challenges, and stop trying to project some kind of, I don't know, image into the world, but rather just be honest and authentic, then I actually automatically feel other people can come in to support me and connect and see themselves in that, you know, in that struggle. So I saw that early on, that once I was honest about myself. I mean, I think especially as a yoga teacher, because I think yoga teachers have unfortunately bought into this idea that we have to be above other people or superior or achieved in something, in physical health, mental ability, spiritual awakening, that somehow we're, you know what I mean? That to teach yoga, you somehow have to be enlightened. And it's such a trap, it's such a dangerous trap. And when we can, you know, be authentic and honest about our struggles, and, you know, also the positive things that have come, and the benefits of the practice that they've given us, then I see how other people respond. And I can give you an example. I mean, when I say the next big leap for accessible yoga was about maybe 8 years ago, I had moved away from my, where I've been living for 30 years. I moved to Southern California and I left my yoga community, and I was really struggling again for the first time. I mean, it's always these struggles that help me move in my life. You know, I don't want to admit that, but, you know, it's the big challenges that have offered huge benefit and rewards. And this is what happened. I moved and I was lost completely. I had no spiritual community. I barely knew anyone. I didn't know anyone down here. And then I started to realize that other people must feel the same way. You know, that other yoga teachers, especially those who work in the area that I'm interested in, and that is yoga, bringing yoga to people who don't normally have access, that we don't have a community, we don't have a support network, and that especially at that time, the yoga media didn't reflect our work. It didn't reflect anything about what I saw myself doing as the teacher. You know what I mean? Like, the yoga media showing these gymnastic practices has nothing to do with my practice or my teaching or the community I'm part of and the people I see who are just transforming their lives through yoga. It is not reflected at all in that general view. And so I had this idea of supporting them in another way. Actually, I can tell you one more story that I do like to share about, I think you'd appreciate this one. I moved down here and I knew one person in town here. Her name's Sherry Clampin, and she's a great yoga teacher. She teaches yoga for cancer and therapeutic yoga. But I was watching her. I had no work. I had just moved and I was like, oh, I was thinking I have to start all over again. I have to do things that yoga teachers have to do, which is really a lot. And I found myself very jealous of her. And so I went into this kind of negative place. And then I realized that that jealousy, again, was my ego talking. And how could I work with that and use yoga to really transform that within myself, that feeling of jealousy? Because I knew in my heart that jealousy for her, I mean, she was teaching yoga for people with cancer, and I was jealous of that. And I thought, what is that? That's what a strange, you know, this kind of professional jealousy thing. But I was like, that's such a strange thing. I love her. I love what she's doing. I want to celebrate her, you know, and look how I've turned it into, you know, my ego has turned it into some kind of a negative thing. And when I saw it clearly in a glimpse, literally, I saw, and what I realized was I need to support her. And I had this vision of her on a stage of like, oh, I need to put her up on stage. Like, I need to lift her up. And that was in opposition to what my ego wanted, right? Because my ego was kind of wanting me to be lifted. And I thought, no, it's not that. I love her work. And I really do admire her so much. And literally, that's how I had this idea of doing a conference, of having an accessible yoga conference I had her on stage. And many others, you know, and I basically created a platform for the voices of people whose work I admire and who I wanted to hear them speaking. So I created that platform myself, and it served me. I mean, it served me incredibly well. I benefited from it. I got the platform. But I think it was only because I was able to get out of my ego for even just a moment that some progress could occur. Then my ego came marching back in.
But this recognition of those instants of initiation, right, you know, around that particular capacity. And I'll tell you what happened to me when I was listening to you. I had this view of you as someone, and you described it as being on the margins. And then I saw you, as you were speaking, actually benefit from that original position of being an outsider. And that optimization, so to speak, that amplification that you also spoke about relative to the moving through the what had been the doubt, or like we like to say in Buddhist practice, that you had to take out those piercings from your heart so it could actually feel that sympathetic joy for your colleague. And so here's the, we're coming down to the end here, these emerging capacities or qualities from a leadership perspective. This is where part of the readership will want to know from you, from a self-reflective perspective, what are some of those qualities and capacities that from your practice have emerged into your leadership competencies? So this is the throughput from your practices, what's landed in you that are now recognizable qualities.
Well, can I read another sloka? This is my favorite one of all. And it's directly after directly after the section I read to you, where basically Krishna is saying, here it is, here's what you need to do. And he says, this is number 70 in chapter 2. Someone with personal desires will not experience true peace. But when all desires merge like different rivers flowing into the vast deep ocean, then peace is easily realized. And to me, that speaks to that question about leadership, actually, which is to, in a way, I mean, I guess I'm repeating myself, say again, to be honest about my own needs and my ego and reveal that to my community, reveal that to people where I'm struggling and where I'm, where I am human, and that, reveal that to them. And then in return, they show me theirs. They show me their suffering and their humanity, and I think we can see how that merges together. And again, it's not that we are all one, it's not that simple, but it's just that in the end, I think so much of the struggle that we share individually is shared. There's shared pain and suffering over different things. You know, what I'm struggling over may be different than the details of someone else's life, but I think the fact is we struggle and we suffer. And to find the connected humanity in that feels important. I also think, Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say this sloka means a lot to me because I also think this sloka is about seeing how the threads of our lives connect together and how there's this general like move towards connection that we want. Like our heart wants to be connected, you know, spiritually and in community. And literally, I think like there's no difference. Like to me, like spiritual awakening is community connection. Like that is what it is. That is the same thing. Just like I would say creativity is spirituality. Like it's all basically different verbs or something, different words for the same idea of connection, moving beyond the individual limitations that we have from the ego mind. So I think in that sloka, there's this feeling for me of like looking beyond the kind of small everyday challenges that I'm facing to be able to see my journey, like you're helping me to do here, to see my journey as in a more what's the word, you know, a bigger picture, and then be able to somehow offer that vision to other people too, you know. Maybe that's what leadership is just to be able to show like the vision of your own life and the journey you've taken, and to be sharing that with others.
So can I give you just a visual on, so as you were speaking, and it's so interesting, you were going like this. So you just created your own new mudra, and then you took it and you offered it out. So I mean, it was so true from the way that your arms went open, and then they came from the heart, and then you were in your like mind reflecting on the external, even though it's a beautiful thing to read. I watched it all just kind of land in your system. And then there was something else that happened. So what happened when the arms went up and out? And you also flushed and you smiled.
I mean, I can feel the presence of other people and, you know, the people I love and the people who I feel, yeah, connected to a community. Like I feel their presence, and I want to be, you know, I still continue to want to serve them and connect with them. And it's so interesting right now when we can't be physically together, but it also helps to highlight the fact that it's not a physical connection anyway. So it's been useful in a sense, right?
Oh my goodness, so useful. So it's time to leave. However, I am getting the word that I'd like to share with you, which is activation. And so part of these sparks of inspiration that then come in through the field of our inquiry, right, from our study, from our practice, there is this moment of, just like you demonstrated, of the sharing of something. And we might not know what the result of is it yet, but you so beautifully described the intersection, right? That moment when you had the vision, right? Here we go again to your visual genius about seeing. And that's the future, right? So if you were to leave the readers with the way in which you know that you see the future, mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I would say that, you know, to me, yoga practice is just that, is not just envisioning the future, but actually the present, you know, really being present to that connection that exists, whether we feel it or not, between us and others, and also nature. I mean, that connection that, you know, we're seeking in yoga is simply just an awareness of what's already there. But in terms of envisioning a future, I would say the more we can be in that place of connection, which means that we are feeling like loving towards ourselves and towards others, then I think we can create something from there. We can create something really positive and useful from that place. Yeah.
Thank you, Divinah. So nice to be together. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're great. Those are great questions. I appreciate your inquiry.
Thank you. So stay tuned. I'll be in touch around a few other things that I'll ask you to write, bio type things like that.
Okay, sure. Yeah, good luck with your project.
Thank you so much. Be well. Take care.
Okay.